Chapter 86. The Approach. Mirelle ascended the Tower of the Shalanes for the first time in her life. Volney had tried to convince her that such an ascent was a poor idea, but the young man's complying nature could never hold a resolution long enough to cross her for too long. Gadeon had been four times the stubborn mule that Volney was, and she had managed that old soldier for most of her life. The tower, used to house a decoy for the Shalanes, was also the best vantage point for a clear view of the King's Blood Lake and the city of Mickmere that surrounded it. A clear view, however, was hard to come by anymore. The burning sky had persisted for 2 days before finally subsiding, and the smoke and haze had turned the days into twilight. Some of the flaming chunks of the moons had driven craters into the ground and set fields ablaze, though as for that, since Eldaluri Mora had been destroyed, the crops and trees had withered steadily. Whether from the darkening of the sky, or some loss of the essence of Kihal, no one could say. Unused to the veil she had worn since her daughter left, Mirelle had to pick her way carefully up the dark, narrow staircase that led to the circular upper room and its advantageous prospect. Since the events of Echo Hold, the decoys had retired from their post, so when Mirelle and Volney opened the gilded door, they found the richly appointed room dusty and smelling stale. Mirelle thought the furnishings and decorations had probably not changed since the first decoy for the Shalanes had roomed there. The tapestries were faded, and the blocky, bold furniture was out of style with the more modern, delicate pieces that tended to curve and sport clever filigrees. The reds of the carpets and dark woods of the room's appointments almost gave it an Augmerian feel. Not bothering with the closed shutters, they crossed to another door that opened onto a balcony that encircled the entire tower, allowing a view in every direction. It was stuck fast, and only a vigorous yank from Volney freed it. "We shouldn't spend too much time out of doors," he said firmly, and Mirelle smiled. She could almost feel like the Shalane again back when she had been overprotected and shut away. "We won't be long," Mirelle promised as they stepped out. The sense of vertigo took a moment to beat down. A chest-high balustrade protected them from a fall, but regularly spaced, arched cutouts left enough of the precipitous view in sight to send her heart into her throat. Volney paled. "I grew up on a plane," he lamented by way of explanation. From the tower, the smoke and the haze actually seemed worse. An enthusiastic breeze did little to alleviate the gritty dust and ash greys soiling the air. The sharp smell of smoke pervaded everywhere, some columns of fire still rising from burning fields without the city walls. Feeling more comfortable with their elevated perch, Mirelle leaned against it while Volney stood at obedient attention with his back flat to the tower wall, as if stuck to it. 4 days ago, Falael and Maywin had encountered the vanguard of Mikik's awful host as they reached the eastern edge of Rugoth. The people there had long since fled, but Mikik's servants had not lost an opportunity to raise and burn everything in their path. If Maywin was correct, the army would reach the fortified lower wall of Mickmere by nightfall, with one purpose: to root through every building until they found the Shalane and deprived her of her life. Mirelle peered to the east. There was nothing save some procrastinating stragglers who had taken their time before heeding the warning that had followed on Jen's and the Shalane's heels after they secretly left the city. The thought of the two of them stung Mirelle's eyes. She missed them both terribly and had been so distraught when they said farewell that she hugged her daughter for so long that she and Jen had started much later than they intended. Mirelle had even kissed Jen on the lips in front of his intended bride, though she hoped it was a short enough peck to avoid suspicion of her true feelings. The two of them were all she truly loved in the world, and to send them off to an uncertain and dangerous fate, far from where she could help or counsel either one, aggravated her emotions and made her restless. Even worse, she felt useless. She was bait. The generals knew far better than she how to handle the impending war, but she desperately wanted to grab a sword and do something. The inner courtyard of the castle below her stirred with relentless activity, the once beautiful grounds now littered with temporary accommodations and the refuse of the soldiers who lived there. The bulk of the combined armies of Tolnor and Mickmere occupied the streets of the city. the mass of fleeing citizenry they had sent north and west out of the path of Mikkik's creatures, that many people had refused to leave and found themselves host to soldiers quartered with them. As yet, no word had come from Ogmir, though Mirel still held out hope that they would come to Rugarth's relief. While Maywen had been unsure of the exact numbers of the enemy they faced, she assured them that to her eyes it appeared Mikkik had scraped every nook and cranny of Kihol and sent what he found to Rugarth. "We should descend, milady," Volney suggested after a stiff wind picked up. Mirel turned toward him. "Where did you send your wife, Lena, and her boy?" "To family in the north. I have a granduncle there who has a fortified estate that is a bit out of the way. It's the best I could have hoped for." Mirel nodded. "She'll be much safer than any of us. You most of all. I must thank you again for volunteering for this duty. I am sure you would prefer to be in the streets with Gerund." "I am honoured that Lord Mikmir, well, Jen or whatever, chose me for this post, though I certainly could not fill Cadean's shoes. I wish I would have been with him and Jen in Echo Hold when they came for you." Her days imprisoned in Echo Hold and being dragged along the streets to the burning pole seemed a blurry haze in her mind, and she wondered if Jen had done some trick of Min magic to soften the memory of those awful events. All she could remember was the rapturous joy of finding Jen alive and making sure he felt her delight. Her sorrow for Cadean's death, while poignant, had lost its weight in the revelation of Jen's return from the same fate. "Look there, milady," Volney said urgently, finally taking a step away from the tower, "in the eastern sky. I see nothing but a cloud. But no. That's a flock of birds," Volney said. "I wasn't there, but didn't some flock of birds attack Lord Jen?" "Yes. Joran called it Sethradron, which apparently means the horror of birds. Hecadron was the beetles. Jen thinks he destroyed it. This just gets worse and worse. Snakes, beetles, now birds." As the lustrous, deadly birds neared the city through the murky sky, their awful shrieking call pierced Mirel's and Volney's ears. Trumpets and commotion responded in the streets below, and a cloud of arrows rose to meet the avian threat. Some few birds plummeted from the sky, but the entire flock swarmed downward into the ranks of soldiers in the city, diving and then rising again. A small pocket of birds broke away from the main group and pushed against the wind toward the tower where they watched. Volney grabbed her arm. "It's begun. You're underground from now on." She didn't resist as he pulled her away and slammed the door shut. No one was sure how many of the magical protections about the Shalane's complex still worked. As they closed the gilded door and started down the stairs, the sound of broken glass and snapping shutters preceded the raucous din of Mikkik's birds streaming into the deserted room. They had come for her, and it was time to hide. Gerund fussed with his helmet, unused to wearing one. In his younger days training with his father, he would hardly be caught without one, but now a helmet was proving a nuisance. He sat astride his horse in the streets of the inner city of Mikmir. The outer city was abandoned, save for the most stubborn of the citizenry, and the main eastern gate was shut. General Harband and his hardened army took the honour of defending the main approach, and Gerund was glad. When he had arrived in Tolnor as ambassador, he found that with the death of his brother, he had become the duke of his estate. He felt ill-prepared to lead the men he had mustered to come with him. His portion of the Tolnorian army, consisting of 300 foot soldiers and 50 knights, occupied a road two streets north of where General Harband's men waited for the impending attack. Between them was General Tarun, Volney's father. General Harband placed most of the Tolnorian regiments in support positions, since they were, as a whole, unfamiliar with the city and exhausted from frantic preparations and travel. They came ready to fight, however, and Gerund was proud of them for taking up a cause not immediately their own. Of course, most hoped to catch a glimpse of the famous Alderdon Mikmir, and the legend's absence fueled some disgruntled talk. Why would the king abandon his city in its time of need? Gerund kept to the standard explanation. The king was travelling to drum up more support and had no doubt been hindered by the dangerous paths he was forced to tread. It held up for the most part, but if the leaders ever put their heads together and discussed it, they might find that Alderdon Mikmir had bidden no one come. Messengers had spread the word, and the regents and soldiers of Mikmir had answered the call of their missing monarch. To Gerund's left, Baron Rickon sat staring into the dirty sky. the skin around his blue eyes lined from his many hours out in the sun. His bronze and silver breastplate held the device of a bear. The man was built straight and tall and had the look of old leather. Gerund was glad to have him. He was an experienced soldier who had won much honour during the war with Ogmir when King Fillingrail withdrew from the Fidelium. But even more soothing to Gerund was Maewyn, who stood at his right, also peering into the sky but with her head slightly cocked. Why she had chosen to fight alongside him instead of General Harband or anyone else was a mystery to Gerund, but he wouldn't complain. On her back, her quiver brimmed with long arrows crafted after the elven fashion, and her hands were on the hilts of her curved, long knives.
"What is it?" Gerund asked.
She waited, silent, for a few moments. Baron Rickon leaned over, listening.
"It will begin soon," she said. "I hear their voices on the wind."
"Whose?"
Gerund asked.
"The fell shrieks of Sethra Drone. Get them up and ready. The vanguard will be upon us soon."
Gerund gave the signal to the herald and he blew the call to arms, his men scrambling from alleys and houses to gather to the street. A single knight, bearing the white hammer device of the Toruns, rode up from the next street over and approached.
"General Torun asks why you have sounded the call to arms."
"Sethra Drone is nearly here," Gerund explained. "Get your men ready."
"We have seen no threat."
"You will hear it first," Maewyn said. "Your poor ears could hear it now if you would quiet yourselves. The cry of the birds is heavy on the air."
Gerund signalled for silence, and the rider waited. For several moments, only the sound of the wind whipping along the street rewarded their attention, but just as everyone started to relax, the horrifying shriek of the fell birds carried over the wall and into their ears. It sounded like the cries of 100 girls screaming in pain. No more explanation was needed, and the rider galloped away while the men and horses formed their lines.
"It would be best to preserve the horses," Maewyn counselled. "They will give you no advantage against the birds. Hide them in houses and alleys. Do it quickly."
"My Lord Kildan,"
the Baron objected.
"I see no need to."
"Just do it,"
Gerund said, dismounting his horse.
"I've long since learned not to argue with someone who is over 200 years old."
Maewyn nodded appreciatively as Gerund gave the order to the rest of his reluctant knights, finding himself needing to put a little angry fire in his commands to get the soldiers to respond with the proper celerity.
"Now listen,"
Gerund yelled, raising his voice over the swelling shriek of the birds.
"Lord Micmir encountered these birds when he stood against Mickic. Do not think of attack first. Use your shields to keep them away from exposed flesh. Their beaks wound like long daggers, and if you are stabbed, you must treat the wound immediately. There is something foul in their beaks that makes a wound bleed long and hard. A puncture cannot be neglected. Now, gather your courage. These are but birds that can be defeated if you are disciplined and careful. You will face worse in the coming days. More importantly, do not flail wildly at them. If you have a clear chance to kill one, take a sure stroke. But it is most important to weather this assault without injury."
No sooner had he given the advice than the dark cloud of the flock rose over the outer wall to their right and dove downward toward Harban's men. A volley of arrows took a small toll on the birds, but the mighty swarm pelted downward below the roofline. The yells of men and the terrified screaming of horses echoed down the streets, and the birds burst again into the sky, flying low and driving down again in a different spot, spreading themselves farther apart from each other. An armoured horse, riderless and eyes wild, galloped in a frenzy toward Gerund. Blood ran in streams down its flanks and belly from several puncture wounds, leaving a red trail on the road. A single bird clung to the horse's head with sharp talons, and with a thrust of its own head, drove its beak through the horse's skull and into its brain. The animal collapsed, the bird taking flight until an arrow speeding from Maewyn's bow brought it down. Gerund regarded his soldiers, sweating and nervous to a man. Give them a line of Orcmerian soldiers, and they would all lick their lips at the chance for battle. Throw a flock of Mickic's birds at them, and they were shaking. Every eye scanned upward for the dark fowl peppering the sky, and then disappearing just as quickly. Gerund hoped to escape their notice altogether, but such luck did not attend them.
"Prepare!"
Maewyn yelled, the men pulling their shields close. Gerund stepped close to Maewyn, who had nothing with which to protect herself. She didn't refuse his aid, and then the birds were upon them. The pounding wings hammered them as the demonic birds descended upon them in a cloud of fury. Beaks and sharp talons whined against protective shields and armour, and curses and gasps of pain from the wounded mingled with the horrible cries of the birds.
"Damnable things!" Baron Rickon yelled, swiping the air with his broadsword, cleaving a bird in two, but one of its companions streaked down and avenged it, beak sinking into the Baron's eye.
Dropping his shield, the Baron fell hard to the ground and rolled over onto his stomach, two more birds taking advantage of the exposed backs of his legs. Geraint batted them away with his sword, a bird slashing down and grinding against his arm greave before leaping away. The birds rose as one and departed to terrorize some other part of the city. And while only seconds had passed, Geraint felt weary. How could he lead men against such a foe? The safest move seemed to be to abandon their posts and get inside the dwellings and buildings around them. But he feared that was what Mikik wanted, so he could sneak some other horror inside the walls with no defense prepared. They bound the wounded quickly, a pool of blood gathered around Baron Rickon's stricken eye. Despite Maywin's quick ministrations, he died in minutes.
"How can such a thing be fought?" Geraint muttered under his breath.
Maywin heard him anyway.
"Jen said that one of the creatures hosts the spirit that controls the rest. He told me he used Min magic to locate it when he fought Hecadron, but we have no such aid now. We must endure it and exact what vengeance we can upon it."
"It will sap the morale of the men."
"Morale is your responsibility," Maywin said, patting him on the shoulder.
Geraint ground his teeth. His morale wasn't particularly firm at the moment, and he didn't have much to offer other than to be with his men. In the respite from the attack, he wandered among them, trying to sound confident and in command, but he felt like a child when he looked into the weathered and battle-scarred faces of the more seasoned warriors around him.
"Any one of them would be better at this than I am," he thought.
In a moment of idle reflection, he wondered if the Chukas even bothered to check on their Uyumark charges after a battle, and that's when the thought struck him.
"Maywin!"
he yelled, running back toward the front.
"Come with me!"
Geraint gave command of the men to one of his knight lieutenants, and he and Maywin ran forward toward the walls, wary of the erratic rise and fall of the birds.
"What are we doing?" Maywin asked.
"There are two kinds of kings when it comes to war," Geraint began. "One is the kind who loves his men and rides with them into battle. The other dwells on his own importance and sits back and commands others into battle while he sits back and surveys and executes strategy."
"How does that help us now?"
"I'm not sure it will, but it's worth a chance," Geraint said. "I'm guessing the drones are led by the latter kind of king that wouldn't risk himself in the thick of a fight. We need the vantage point of the walls."
They jogged to the left, where chiseled stone stairs led to the top of the outer wall that looked eastward over the city. Nearly all the men had hunkered down behind its fortifications to wait out the attack of Sethra Drone. The dust from Mikik's approaching army rose in the afternoon sun, his army coming ever closer to the abandoned lower city. Captain Egan joined Geraint and Maywin as they crested the wall.
"What do you need?"
the captain asked, looking frightened.
"Just a look about," Geraint answered.
"Maywin, use those elven eyes and look to the sky. Can you see any bird not with its fellows?"
The three of them scanned the skies, Geraint keeping half an eye on the flock still rising and falling from place to place, leaving screams and curses in its wake. From the height of the walls, Geraint spotted horses running rampant through the streets and men diving indoors to get away from the assault. Blood ran in the grooves of the cobbled roads, the men's hemorrhaging wounds resisting all attempts to staunch them.
"There,"
Maywin said, unlimbering her bow. Geraint followed her gaze. To his eyes, it was just a speck of black against the smoke and dust. But there, hovering on the wind, was a single bird.
"Can you hit it?"
"It is a tricky shot with the distance and the wind," she said, bow creaking as she pulled it back.
Geraint held his breath as she sized up the shot and then loosed the arrow, bowstring singing. They followed the arrow into the sky. Upward it went into the dust and wind, almost impossible to see. To Geraint, the faint spot jerked, ever so imperceptibly, but then it tumbled downward, wounded.
"I hit its wing," Maywin said, disappointed. She lined up another shot as it spiraled down,
but the jerky movements of its descent helped it avoid the killing shot, and it fell behind a nearby house. The flock of birds behind them continued its bloody work, but a group broke off from the main swarm.
"I've got to get down there," Geraint yelled.
He peered over the 20-foot drop. A house rose from the street, its roof 10 feet below. Without taking time to think it through, he stepped up onto a crenellation.
What are you doing? Maywin exclaimed. Cover me! Bending his legs, he leapt outward with all of his strength, aiming for the shake-shingled roof below. While he intended to land in the middle of the sloped side, the weight of his armor and shield rendered his leap much shorter than he had envisioned. He impacted with the lower eave of the roof shield first, sending a numbing shock up his arm. Grunting, he slid down and landed on a decorative wooden planter not intended to take the weight of an armored man. It gave way in a splintering crack, soil and flowers and wood accompanying him to slam into a small gable over a window. He hit the ground with enough force to take the wind out of his lungs. Bruised and battered, he scrambled to his feet and ran for the spot where he had seen the bird fall.
They're coming! Maywin shouted.
The birds screeched and flapped close behind him. Churning his legs with everything he had, Gerund sprinted around a corner, birds wheeling behind him. There on the ground he saw it, a single bird hobbled and hopping away from him. Gritting his teeth, he bowled after it. The small flock of birds engulfed him, their beating wings and shrieks deafening. To his surprise, they did not attack, but passed him to land about their wounded comrade in an attempt to confuse him as to which one held Sethradron's mind. But Gerund knew his target, and with a leap he came down shield first among the small gathering of birds, a satisfying crunch rewarding his efforts while his arm took another painful shot. The birds that could still fly exploded away like crows scared out of a cornfield by the barking of a dog. Gerund rolled over and found the sky filled with a disorderly scattering of birds fleeing masterless in every direction. Coming to a crouch, he looked down at the pulverized remains of Sethradron.
One horror down, he thought.
Taking a couple of moments just to breathe, he stood and walked back to the walls, trying to rub and roll his left arm back into shape. As he cleared the building, a great shout and applause rose from the men on the wall. Maywin staring down with a barely perceptible grin on her face.
Your wife would not approve, she yelled. You are a crazy fool of a man.
That's Duke crazy fool of a man, if you please.
The Shalane's hand went to her mouth as she stared through the gates of Elder Luri Mora. Everything inviting about the city had gone. The entire island a ruined waste. The plants had not just withered and died, they appeared rotten, like spoiled fruit, black and covered in thick clumps of mould. The lake, once clear and blue, now looked sterile and black, corrupted and befouled. The white buildings, while having lost their splendour to a dusty dinginess that clung to them, still stuck out against the decay all about them. Worse, however, the lands all around Elder Luri Mora struggled to live, trees and grass wilted despite the mildness of the summer, and what wildlife they saw moved listlessly if it moved at all. The entire world was falling under a withering lethargy that all in their party could feel wrapping its weight about them every mile closer they came to the stricken city. The Shalane latched on to Jen, finding his face wrenched in sadness. They had speculated that the destruction of Elder Luri Mora would ruin the world, and every step toward the dead city bore witness to it. The effect was spreading. The city had to be restored to its glory and beauty, and they could not delay. But knowing what had to be done had not helped them conjure up a way to do it, and Jen appeared more concerned every day. That she had to bleed, they knew. Where and how much remained a mystery. The journey had favoured them with good fortune, for the most part. The church had not impeded their progress through the portals, and Saturnus's ruse to draw away Mikkik's forces had left their trail empty of foes. Having Jen with her helped her stay calm enough to sleep, though she was pretty sure that all her stealth had failed to conceal from the five knights that accompanied them that she sneaked into Jen's tent every night and didn't come out. What they might think of her, she could hardly care. She knew she was Jen's wife and resolved never to pass through the night without him.
We should be about it, Geran said. It is late afternoon, I think. The haze is just as thick here.
Jen nodded, wearing his worry openly, and pushed the tall gate open. They led their horses forward toward the cracked bridge at a slow pace, the deadness of the place calling forth an instinctual wariness. But they had hardly stepped inside when the skin on their bodies started to desiccate and turn grey. The horses whined and became restless. Only Joran seemed unaffected.
Go back, Jen ordered.
The Shalane grabbed his hand, and all at once the effect dissipated on both of them. their skin returning to its natural colour and suppleness. The knights retreated behind the gate, and Jen and the Shalane led their horses back to safety. Just as Elder Lurimora rejected Mikik's creatures before, it invited them now. All good creatures would suffer under the gross corruption of the city. Jen shook his head. The Milim Eri had changed him, and he was no longer Mikik's creation. The city rejected him now just as it had when he had entered for the Shalane's wedding.
"Stay here," he ordered his men. "I do not know how long this will take, but it will be some hours."
"How can you endure it, Lord Mikmir?"
"Lady Alumira's healing power keeps me safe.
Joran is a creature shaped by Mikik, so this place does not harm her.
Be wary. Mikik may have left a guard about."
The Shalane knew Jen's true fear. What if Mikik himself remained? They had no means or magic to destroy him, though the Shalane, who wore a blade for the first time in her life, hoped for some opportunity to stick him. If the bleeding succeeded and Elder Lurimora was healed, they had agreed to attempt the creation of another weapon to end Mikik for good. Hand in hand, they turned toward the city, Joran already halfway across the bridge, as if anxious to explore a place once forcefully denied her. The Shalane looked up at Jen's sober face and rubbed the beard on his cheek.
"If the world is put right, I will make you shave that awful thing," she said. "It was cute at first, but I miss your naked face. Sometimes I even miss the scars."
He smiled weakly, still distracted, eyes absorbing the wasted landscape.
"Joran," he yelled, "you shouldn't wander too far ahead. There may be dangers."
"Jen," the Shalane whispered, "what's wrong?"
"I just don't know how this will work, Alumira. I want to be sure that what we're about to do is worth the risk. Then I imagine Mikmir in flames, everyone wondering why the legendary king skipped town just before battle. At least I would know what I was doing there. Here, I'm just afraid we're putting your life at risk for a plan we don't know will work."
"Have faith, Jen," she said, squeezing his hand. "When I first came here, I was a lost little girl, afraid of what I had to do. Now the city lays before us, blighted and forbidding, and while I feel sadness, I am not afraid. I can't explain it, but I feel that this is where I should be. It may not be as beautiful as it once was, but both times I have come to this place, I have had the love of the best of men. And this time, I don't have to hide from it."
She stopped, lifted her veil, and kissed him deeply.
"No more sour faces, Lord Mikmir. We will succeed and take our rest from horror and pain."
He kissed her forehead and embraced her.
"Your will, my love."
"Are you two done yet?" Joran hissed from the end of the bridge. "Remember that I'm getting older every moment."
"As are we all," Jen replied. They pressed forward, the eerie silence of the city unnerving. No wind stirred the stale air, and the once blossomed branches now stretched across the road like the gnarled legs of dark spiders. Their footsteps and their voices echoed through the empty streets, and even the jaded Joran pulled back to walk more closely to her companions. The Shalane reached up and touched one of the twigs hanging down, and to their delight it turned green and healthy again under her touch. But once released, it settled into its previous putrefaction.
"Now you see," the Shalane said, "it is my blood that will heal this place."
Jen smiled uncertainly, but the Shalane thought she could catch a glimpse of hope in his eye as they walked up the stairs toward the half-collapsed Hall of Three Moons. Joining Joran, they stood at the threshold and regarded the wreck of the once proud building, now a jumble of broken stones.
"I wonder if Aethon survived this," the Shalane said.
"He must have," Jen speculated, "or we wouldn't have had so easy a time at the portals, I think. But I can see a hand sticking out beneath some rubble. Be careful where you step."
They entered tentatively, their feet crunching small rocks as they pressed forward. A large crack transected the centre of the room, spanning it from side to side. The four thrones on the opposite side of the room were all charred, as Mikik's throne was when they first visited.
"You can see where the crack began," Joran said. "Just there, in the centre of the room. It is there the weapon pierced the floor. It is there she must be bled."
The Shalane swallowed, and they approached the yawning crack. Even with the light streaming through the dusty particles in the air, the chasm appeared to have no bottom, a great yawning hole into nothingness. The Shalane stepped back, feeling vertigo. How could a weapon formed of her blood have split the very ground in two?
"We will lay the Shalane on this stone," Geran began, "and let her blood cover the floor and drip down the crack. It should—"
A scrape behind them spun them around, hands on weapons. But Sir Tornus's familiar shape in the archway put them at ease.
"So you have come at last," he said. "Mekik told me to remain here, and there simply isn't a thing to eat, so you can imagine how hungry I've become. You see that I did my job well. Mekik left for Mikmir immediately and left me all alone. Did I mention how hungry I am? It may be best to destroy me first thing."
"You have fulfilled your end of the bargain," Jen said. "Once we are finished here, I can use my blood to destroy you. I have the essence of the Milimeri flowing through my veins, and only one bleeding should be sufficient to end your life."
Sir Tornus's eyes bulged. "Did I mention that controlling my appetite isn't one of my strong suits? When I see a delicious soul, I really just stick my fork right in, so to speak."
"Do be quiet, Tornus," Geran said acidly. "Why don't you run off and keep watch? Mikik may have left a surprise or two for anyone who might enter here."
"I do believe I was to be the surprise," Sir Tornus answered.
"Very well. Do hurry."
He wandered off toward the door, muttering to himself. The Shalane let Jen help her recline close to the great crack in the center of the floor. She squeezed his hand and felt a little light-headed. From her previous experience, she knew the cuts would hurt, but even worse was watching her blood spill from her and feeling the warm, comfortable slipping away that brought her close to death. With Jen to watch over her, she felt more sure, but Geran she could not trust, despite her assertions of common purpose.
"Teach me the words of healing for blood magic," Geran said.
Jen complied and then reclined next to the Shalane, keeping a tight grip on her hand. He said,
"She and I will bleed together. When we begin to get faint, use my blood to heal her, and then she will heal me. We cannot touch while we bleed, so the curse of this place will be upon us for a short while. You must watch closely, Geran. Lose either one of us, and all is lost. Do you understand?"
"Of course," Geran said. "We must begin before I become too old for my eyes to be of any use."
Jen reached down and removed the dagger from his boot.
"I am sorry, Shalane. I hoped there would be another way."
"It must be done. Let's get it over with."
Jen cut her wrist and then his own. She flinched at the pain, sucking air through her teeth. Jen had long since accustomed himself to cuts and wounds and didn't seem the least perturbed when he bled out onto the floor with her. The darkening and drying skin overtook them almost immediately when they no longer touched, the familiar ashen curse covering her as it once had when she fled in despair from Echo Hold. Her blood spilled away from her onto the floor to drip down the sides of the chasm, Jen's flowing the other way toward the watchful Geran. Just as the woozy sleepiness took her into her own mind, she was healed, and she reached out to Jen immediately, their strength and skin returning to health. They rested for a few moments before Geran prodded them onward.
"Six more times."
Time after time, they bled, each time the summer sun sinking lower and the room dimming. Geran aged with every passing minute, her hair greyer every time the Shalane woke from being healed. Blood slicked the floor in both directions, fanning away from both of them as they endured the awful cutting for the last time.
The last time.
The Shalane's heart leapt with hope. The task was nearly done, and the pain and weakness would end forever. As her life force slipped from her after the seventh cut, she fell into one of her favourite daydreams of living with Jen in Blackshire. They walked among the woods and rivers hand in hand, evening sunlight streaming down as they swam naked in forest pools and laughed around a campfire in the moonlight. And then she awoke, healed, and staring through the broken ceiling into the sky. The smoke and dust in the air from the night of fire cast the sunset into a vibrant orange and blue, ragged clouds taking up the rich colours as they sped past above her. She smiled and turned, reaching out to heal Jen. His blood still flowed away from him, and she was alarmed at how pale he seemed. A foot smashed her hand to the ground, and she yelped.
"Not so quickly, dear,"
Geran said.